previous volume. Volume 1. Niccolo Rising. From Venice to Cathay, from Seville to the Gold Coast of Africa, men anchored their ships and opened their ledgers and weighed one thing against another as if nothing would ever change. This first sentence of the first volume indicates the scope of this series and the cultural and psychological dynamic of the story and its hero, whose private motto is "Change, change and adapt." It is the motto, too, of 15th century Bruges, centre of commerce and conduit of new ideas and technologies between the Islamic East and the Christian West, between the Latin South and the Celtic Saxon North, haven of political refugees from the English Wars of the Roses, a site of muted conflict between trading giants Venice and Genoa, and states in the making and on the take all around. Mrs. Dunnett has set her story in the 15th century, between Gutenberg and Columbus, between Donatello and Martin Luther, between the rise of mercantile culture and the fall of chivalry, as that age of receptivity to, addiction to, change, called the Renaissance, gathers its powers. Her hero is a deceptively silly-looking, disastrously tactless 18-year-old dyeworks artisan named Klaas, a caterpillar who emerges by the end of the novel as the merchant mathematician Nicholas van der Pulle. Prodigiously gifted at numbers and the material and social engineering skills that go with it, Nicholas has until now resisted the responsibility of his powers, his identity fractured by the enmity of both his mother's husband's family, the Scottish St. Paul's, who refuse to own him legitimate, and his maternal family, the Burgundian de Fleury's, who failed his mother and abused him and reduced him to serfdom as a child. He found refuge at age 10 with his grandfather's in-laws, especially the Bruges widow Marianne de Charetti, whose dyeing and broking business becomes the tool of Nicholas's desperate self-fashioning apart from the malice of his blood relatives. Soon, even public Bruges and the states beyond come to see the engineer under the artisan. The Charetti business expands to include a courier and intelligence service between Italian and northern states, its bodyguard sharpened into a skilled mercenary force, its pawnbroking consolidated toward banking and commodities trading. And as the chameleon artificer of all this, Nicholas incurs the ambiguous interest of the Bruges patrician Ansel Mardone and the Greco-Florentine prince Nicolai Giorgio di Acciaiuoli, both of whom steer him toward a role in the rivalry between Venice, in whose interest Acciaiuoli labours, and Genoa, original home of the Adorn family. This trading rivalry will erupt in different novels around the different, always highly symbolic commodities, silk, sugar, glass, gold, and human beings. In this first novel, the contested product is alum, the mineral that binds dyes to cloth, blood to the body, conspirators to a conspiracy, in this case, to keep secret the news of a newly found deposit of the mineral in the Papal States while Venice and her allies monopolize the current supply. Acciaiuoli and Adorn are father-mentor figures Nicholas can respect, resist, or join on roughly equal intellectual terms. Whereas the powerful elder males of his blood, his mother's uncle, Jacques de Fleury, and his father's father, Jordan de Ribérac, steadily rip open wounds first inflicted in childhood. In direct conflict, he is emotionally helpless before them. What he possesses superbly, however, are the indirect defences of an engineer. The Charetti business partners and others who hitch their wagons to his star, Astor, the mercenary leader, Julius, the notary, Gregorio, the lawyer, Tobias Beventini, the physician, the Guinea slave, Lopez, watch as a complex series of commodity and currency manoeuvres by the apparently innocent Nicholas brings about the financial and political ruin of de Fleury and de Ribérac. And they nearly desert him for the conscienceless avenger he appears to be, especially after de Fleury dies in a fight with, though not directly at the hands of, his nephew. The faith and love of Marianne de Charetti make them rethink their view of this complicated personality. Marianne, whose son was killed beside Nicholas in the Italian Wars and whose sister married into his family, is moved towards the end of the novel to suggest that Nicholas take her in marriage. It is to be platonic, her way of giving him standing, of displaying her trust in him and his management of the business, and of solacing him in his anguish. Once married, however, she longs, despite herself, for physical love, and Nicholas, who owes her